which is 11AP685, State of Wisconsin versus Lamont L. Travis. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Christopher Wren. Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor. When this court writes its decision, the state would like the court to do six things.
Well, that's a lot.
I know, and it's a complicated, it's a kind of a strange case, but there are six things that we hope you'll do. The first is to reverse the Court of Appeals decision, which is, of course, why we're here, what we're arguing on behalf of. And in the course of doing that, second, to affirm that Tiepelman, as supplemented by this court's decision in Harris on the burden of proof, that Tiepelman remains the correct statement of the law when a defendant claims that a circuit court has relied on inaccurate information when imposing a sentence. And that is that once the defendant satisfies his or her burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the sentencing court actually relied on inaccurate information, the state then has a right to show that the court's reliance did not affect this court's sentencing decision. As a corollary to that, we're asking that the court reject the amicus's request to abandon harmless error as the analytical framework for claims of inaccurate information at sentencing. Tiepelman, in our view, is in accord with the U.S. Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit in terms of deciding that harmless error applies to inaccurate information at sentencing cases. In the supplemental authority that I submitted 2 days ago, the Seventh Circuit in Adigan cites to a U.S. Supreme Court case in one of its previous cases for that proposition. We also ask that the court explicitly repudiate the Court of Appeals holding that sentencing court reliance on inaccurate information can qualify as structural error. In our view, inaccurate information sentencing can never qualify as structural error as it's been defined by the U.S. Supreme Court and this court. We also ask that you apply harmless error analysis to Travis's inaccurate information claim and hold that any actual reliance is harmless. Or better yet, from our point of view, which we believe is supported by the record, accept the circuit court's assertion that it did not rely on the mandatory minimum sentence when imposing its sentence, that when there's no reliance, there's no need to consider harmless error.
Regardless of what it actually said at sentencing?
What the court says at sentencing goes into that part of that analysis of whether it's harmless or not, or whether it relied on that information.
Mr. Wren, don't we have to look at both the transcript in regard to sentencing and the transcript in regard to what was said at the post-conviction motion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we do that, doesn't it come across, and I'm asking you whether it comes across, doesn't it come across that Judge Warren is basically saying, well, yeah, I considered this. It wasn't the primary consideration, but it was a consideration. But then I really looked at this guy's prior record. Doesn't he say that? How do we ignore that?
He says at one point in the post-conviction motion hearing, he said, well, I suppose at some level it came in. But what I was focusing on was his character, the nature of the crime, and that goes to the question of the level at which the defendant has to show actual reliance, because that's the mechanism when dealing with inaccurate information. First, the defendant has to show by clear and convincing evidence that there was inaccurate information, and second, that the court actually relied on it. And I think because the ADA said, we think it's harmless. She made the harmless error argument. But I think that what Judge Warren did was back it off one step and say, well, I didn't even actually rely on it. I mean, at some level, he referred to it, of course, when he was making his statements at the sentencing hearing, in the context in which he stated it, was that I had to recite this as part of my obligation to inform the defendant at the time of what he was being charged with and what the penalties were. But beyond that, when he actually got to making the statement about why he was imposing a sentence, he never refers to the mandatory minimum. He's talking consistently about the, about Travis's record, about the fact that he had a prior sexual assault conviction, that he doesn't learn when he's out, that as soon as he gets out, he gets drunk and he commits more crimes. And those were the things that affected the sentence. He never refers to the mandatory minimum at that point. So I think at that, when you look even at the transcript, which is of the post-conviction motion hearing, which is where the judge gets a chance to explain, if there's any doubt, gets to explain what was on his or her mind at that time of sentencing. I think that the fact that he says, well, you know, at some point, you know, it's there. It certainly isn't ignored, but it didn't affect the decision that I made about the sentencing. I think that's what the post-conviction motion, what his statement of the post-conviction motion hearing said, and certainly that was the import of it, and that that's buttressed and fully supported by the by his statements at the sentencing hearing.
Well, let's assume that we apply a harmless error here. What do we do with the situation that exists? You've got the court and everybody else involved initially relying on the wrong statute.
Mm-hmm.
The judgment of conviction shows the wrong statute.
Right.
What do we do? We don't do any resentencing and we don't do anything about the judgment of conviction?
Well, when the, as we know from this court's decision in Allen on pleading requirements, the defendant gets to decide what the nature of the claim is that's going to be considered by the circuit court. And you don't go outside that claim. The claim here was one of inaccurate sentencing. In effect, from my point of view, and from and certainly with my colleagues with whom I discussed this, what we wondered was, why wasn't this a request for plea withdrawal? Why wasn't this a request for ineffective assistance of counsel instead of a claim of inaccurate sentencing? Now that's kind of addressed in Mr. Travis's brief, but from our point of view, when a defendant makes a claim, that defines the scope. And so even if there were all these other things that went on, the nature of an inaccurate information claim is what occurred at sentencing, not what people were relying on at the criminal complaint, at the preliminary hearing stage, at the plea bargain stage, or at the sentencing stage is where it really matters. And that's where it's confined. And that's why it becomes a claim that can be assessed by harmless error, because it's confined to that part of the proceeding, and it's ascertainable by reading the transcripts, by hearing what the judge says about his decision, whether that in fact was harmless, whether it satisfies the harmless error standard. Now, one of the things that we didn't discuss and that I'm not asking the court to decide is whether there's the same harmless error standard applies to this claim. If you look at the federal cases where they deal with the question of inaccurate information and harmless error, they just talk about whether it affected the decision. They don't talk about whether it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't affect. They just say, did it affect the decision? This court has said routinely that the harmless error standard is the same for all claims. We're not asking I think that this satisfies the harmless error standard regardless of what standard you might elect to choose. But we don't think you have to address that question in this case. We certainly haven't briefed it. And we're not asking you to change the harmless error standard in this case.
So doesn't the record here indicate that the trial court and, in fact, the defense attorney, everyone involved, was under the impression prior to and at sentencing that there was a 5-year statutory minimum?
Yes, that's correct.
And it seemed to me that the judge was attempting to exercise his obligation of making sure that the plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary by, on several occasions, reminding the defendant of the 5-year statute, of the 5-year minimum.
Yes.
And so, if we adopt a harmless error analysis, as opposed to a structural error, isn't that almost per se a harm, if the judge is under the impression, how is that not harmless? If the judge thinks that the judge has no authority to go under 5 years, isn't that then going to be the judge's starting point?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that the judge said, I was looking at your record, and I thought that this amount of time was necessary. Doesn't make any reference. I don't think when he says that at some level we all knew that there was this assertion that a 5-year minimum applied. I read the judge's statement at the post-conviction motion hearing when this was brought up as saying it didn't affect it. I wouldn't have given a different sentence.
Don't we have to view the record though in its totality? Are we limited simply to the post-sentencing hearing?
I think when you make an inaccurate information claim, yes. I think that's what defines the scope of what the court's inquiry is. What happened at sentencing? Was there inaccurate information at sentencing? Was it actually relied on? And if you reach the conclusion that it was, then whether that reliance was harmless. But what went on before that, I don't think matters.
So we don't, I thought in response to one of Justice Crooks's questions, you indicated that we do have to look at the sentencing hearing transcript.
Yes. Okay. I agree. Yes, you look at the sentencing hearing transcript to see what the judge said. And then when the claim comes up, he relied on inaccurate information when imposing the sentence. Then the judge at the post-conviction hearing offers an additional explanation about what his thinking was at the time of the sentencing. I think it was clear at the sentencing that the 5-year minimum didn't affect what his decision was. But at the post-conviction hearing, he amplifies on that and says...
Why are we limited simply to... What do you rely on for the proposition that we are limited to review of the sentencing hearing transcript and the post-sentencing hearing?
Well, I don't know that you've ever had to decide that. And it seems to me that if you're making a claim of what occurred... if you're making... For instance, the defendant makes a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea hearing... I wasn't advised correctly or anything like that, you don't go back to the prelim and ask about what happened there. You ask what was happening, what did your attorney say to you that led you to plead? You don't ask him you don't go back and ask what led you to waive. I mean, even if that information might have been in the back there, hanging around in the back like Judge Warren's kind of suggests about the 5-year minimum. It's kind of there, but that's not what is affecting the decision at that particular point in the trial or in the proceeding. This kind of gets to the last point I'm hoping that you'll address in your opinion.
Is this your fifth or sixth?
Sixth. All right. In the end, uh-oh. And it's not really a legal point. It's more kind of an administration point, and that is I'm hoping that in the strongest language that you can use, you will recommend that attorneys, judges, use checklists when they're going through these things. I think I think it's pretty clear that people weren't using checklists. They weren't using jury instructions. They weren't using special materials. They weren't using. I'm not even sure that they were looking at the statute itself. Because if they'd used checklists, if they'd looked at the statute and lined it up with the complaint, the information, the colloquies at the change of plea hearing. I don't think we'd be here today.
Well, all you're telling us is don't make mistakes.
Well, in a sense, but I think that this court pressing attorneys to not make mistakes by going to the materials they already have available and making sure that they're using them is going to help reduce the number of errors and reduce the workload of the courts.
Spotted immediately on asking about the facts, because the element that was missing, if I understand this case, was force or violence.
Right.
So when there was a restatement of the facts, and are these the facts of the case,
right.
If anyone had read the statute, if anyone had read the complaint, right, that was in the record,
right,
it was really obvious. Instead, there's a guilty plea to facts don't substantiate the plea.
That yes and maybe no. part of the difficulty here, I think, has to do with what happened between the time of the filing of the complaint, where there were inadequate facts pled, to sustain the charge under the statute that was cited. They waived the prelim. They waived the prelim and then went to the information, where the information it doesn't cite facts. It cites the statute. Mm-hmm. It recited the same statute. They go to the change of plea hearing, and they're pleading to the information, plus anything else that might be in the record that would support that claim.
It's in the record.
Pardon?
The complaint is in the record.
Complaint is in the record.
The defendant got the complaint?
Certainly the attorney did.
Okay. And the plea questionnaire said he went through everything with the lawyer. With the lawyer and the defendant, right?
That's my understanding, yes. But when they go through the information, and they get the plea, the statute that's charged the information, doesn't necessarily have to match up with what was in the complaint. If there was an omission in the complaint, that can get, in a sense, kind of sanitized. If you go through the prelim and you wind up with, if you actually have a prelim where you present evidence. And you wind up with information that wasn't in the complaint that would support the charge. Here, in my view, the defendant was ill-served because they went all the way through without looking at and determining whether there were additional facts to support that the force or violence. When they get to the change of plea hearing, they don't rely on just the information or the complaint. The judge says, and by virtue of this CAC interview, I find that there's a sufficient basis, factual basis for this. Well, the problem is now we don't have the CAC interview in the record, but apparently the judge knew it. The defense counsel knew it. In fact, defense counsel says defense counsel was the one who actually brought up the CAC interview. And the judge said, well, based on the CAC interview and the defense attorney saying...
It's a CAC interview.
Oh, that's the Child Advocacy Center, one of their employees interviewed the child. That interview is not in the record. It was not included for whatever reason as part of the record. So the judge asked, well, have you discussed this? Has your client seen this interview? The defense attorney says, well, I didn't have a chance to actually show it to him, but I looked at it and I discussed it with him, and he's not contesting it, what this child said in the interview. So the judge says, based on the allegations of the complaint and the CAC interview, I'm finding a sufficient factual basis. Well, the question is, does the CAC interview have sufficient information in it? My argument in the Court of Appeals was, and the Court of Appeals called it frivolous, was that since
maybe
it's not,
we'll take you.
Pardon?
I said maybe we'll be persuaded by you.
By that my argument.
By your frivolous argument.
Yeah. Well,
don't think so. Okay,
I made the argument that we frequently make, which is it's the appellant's burden to have the information in the record. If it's not there, it presumably supports the judgment. I don't know where you go from there. I mean, those are the kinds of anomalies in this case that make it very difficult to figure out exactly what the problem was. But our position is that by making a claim of inaccurate information at sentencing, the rest of that kind of wipes out, because the defendant's not claiming that I didn't enter a plea that I want to withdraw. He's not making a claim that his attorney was ineffective for failing to advise him. He's saying the judge relied on inaccurate information. So the question is, what do we do with inaccurate information claims? Our position is that inaccurate information is not a structural error. It's an error that is susceptible to harmless error analysis, and that's the default standard for any kind of analysis of a claim of error.
Mr. Wren, let's assume for the purposes of this oral argument that I agree that this is not what is generally called structural error.
Okay.
The defendant here says that there's inaccurate sentencing information in this record. You agree with that?
I agree with it because a concession by the ADA, yes.
Well, take away the... Go ahead. In the circuit court?
In the circuit court, yes.
Take away the concession.
Okay.
It was information sent, said numerous times by the circuit court judge that there's a mandatory minimum.
Right.
Right?
Based on the plea.
Right. But the actual crime here that was proved up, that should have been in the complaint, was not a mandatory minimum crime. Is that right?
If I take away the concession, I don't agree with that.
Because okay,
my position has been that at the sentencing, or at the change of plea, there was a sufficient factual basis stipulated to by defense counsel based on both the information and the CAC. And that once they went to the sentencing, that was what they were being sentenced on. The charge to which he pled, which was a 1D offense, not the 1E.
So your position, if I understand it, is he was charged with an offense that had a mandatory minimum.
Correct.
He pled to a defense that had a mandatory minimum.
That's correct.
He was sentenced to a defense that had a mandatory minimum.
That's correct.
So what the heck are we here for?
Because
I mean, that's your position, anything.
Yes, we're here because the Court of Appeals decided it wasn't just an inaccurate information. There was structural error throughout this whole thing, and the remedy for structural error here is simply resentencing. Our position is that if you're claiming inaccurate information, you go with the remedy that we've applied to inaccurate information.
So if the Court of Appeals had been using different language and had said there was error here in sentencing him on the violent offense with a mandatory minimum, he should have been sentenced on no mandatory minimum. There was error. The trial court relied on this error in making a sentence, and that this error prejudiced the defendant.
Okay. I mean, in other words, the state did not prove harmless error.
Right.
Okay.
Then it's that you do resentencing. You wouldn't be here.
I seriously doubt that if the Court of Appeals had written it that way and said we had simply not satisfied our harmless error standard, we would have gone back for resentencing and everything would have been, you know, we wouldn't be here.
You don't want an opinion. Was this one published?
Yes, it was.
You don't want a published opinion saying resentencing error is structural error and you don't get to harmless error.
That's correct. We think that what they've done is redefine, not only redefine, you know, what the standards are for inaccurate information are, but they have also redefined what the nature of structural error is.
Okay, so suppose they had said that, and suppose the state had sought review anyway, and we gave it. So we're right now going to fight about the harmless error test.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So what's the harmless error test we're going to apply that the state has to meet?
Well, I've cited what the state standard has been. And which this court has said is
give me the cite in your page number of the brief.
It's in my brief under the standards of review. Where is this here? It would begin at page 18 of my brief. Basically, it's that, you know, it would be proof beyond a. It's codified by, you know, in both section 805.18.
Harvey Stewart, Sherman, and 805.18. Okay.
Yeah.
And State v. Martin. All right. Various formulations. It's good enough.
And this court has said that the harmless error rule is the same throughout, that it requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless.
And that's the state's burden in this case, because
yes, the state's burden. We do not dispute. I mean, we want to go back to Tiepelman. I mean, we want to make clear that
Tiepelman
is the standard.
Tiepelman accepted the party's stipulation that this should go back for resentencing.
Right.
And that So it didn't ever reach the harmless error issue?
It didn't reach the it did not reach the harmless error standard. It did define by saying that we have a harmless error burden.
Exactly.
Afterwards.
Okay.
And this court in Harris then said that it was clear and convincing.
I want to know whether this court should do a harmless error analysis if you should prevail, or we have to send it back to the trial court to do a harmless error.
Well, I think that...
Because the Court of Appeals did not do a harmless error.
That's correct. It concluded structural error, therefore no, you don't even get to the question of harmless error. Well, I guess that depends on how you assess the record in this case. I assess the record that the court said, I didn't rely on this in the way the trial court accepts that there was an error. The trial court also basically says, I wasn't really relying on this. So if you send it back to the court for harmless error, I think to the trial court, you're essentially saying, I think, that we don't believe you when you said that you didn't rely on this.
Well, the transcript, and I'm looking at the appendix, petitioner's appendix 200, but the transcript goes both ways. You know, that's the problem here, I think. The transcript goes both ways. On petitioner appendix 200, the court is saying, did the court rely on the mandatory minimum? As far as the court's perspective on this, in imposing an 8-year sentence, the sentence was primarily based, and the record should reflect this, not so much on the fact that there was a mandatory minimum perceived to be in place at the time, but that there was, in fact, a substantial prior record involving, among other things, prior sexual assault type offenses. If that's all that was in the record, I would say, he said he didn't primarily rely on it, which of course means he relied on it
somewhat.
Somewhat. And so you lose. But hope springs eternal in the heart of your youth, because on the very next page, the judge says, so far from the court's perspective, the existence or non-existence of a mandatory minimum sentence is of no consequence to this court in its determination of what an appropriate sentence were. Now, so I don't know.
Isn't that an error of law?
Which an error of law?
To say that I'm not guided by whether there's a mandatory minimum. I mean, isn't that the first thing the court should look at in sentencing, whether there's a mandatory minimum?
Well,
is that a question to me or to your colleagues? Oh, okay.
I'm going to ask that privately, but I'm asking you.
Oh, okay,
I mean, that sounds to me like an error law. How can you say you didn't care what the legislature said?
He's not saying he didn't know it, that at least under these circumstances, that there was a mandatory minimum. He's saying the mandatory minimum didn't affect my sentence because I was going to sentence you well beyond the mandatory minimum anyway. Mandatory minimum, it would have only mattered if he was thinking about sentencing below the mandatory minimum, at which point he would have said, well, I would have given you 3 years, but statute says I got to give you 5, so I'm going to give you 5. I think that's what's being driven here. But the other question is, do I lose or do I win? The question, to me, the question is, are those statements by the court relating to actual reliance, whether it relied on the case, on what he's doing? He's saying, well, did it rely? Maybe, but on the other hand, it didn't have any impact. It was irrelevant to me in that regard. To me that also goes to the question of, did I rely?
All I have are the judge's words.
Right, I understand that, but. It makes a difference, I think, because if it goes to the question of actual reliance, it's the defendant's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was actual reliance. If you regard these words as bearing on actual reliance, then the question you have to answer the question, I think, is this clear and convincing evidence that the judge actually relied? Now, I don't think it's clear and convincing. I think it's, you know, as you were saying, Justice Bradley. It's, you know, it's there. It's, you know, it's one way or the other. I don't think that's clear and convincing. If you assume it's clear and convincing, then we get to the question of harmless error and whether that then satisfies the state's burden of showing harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. I think it does, but again, that's going to be a judgment question of law that I think you're going to be answering, and you can take my opinion for I guess whatever it's worth. At the federal level, I don't think they'd be saying proof beyond a reasonable doubt for harmless error. Their language is, did it affect the decision, which I think is a much lower standard, and the courts, certainly in Adigan and the two cases that Adigan cites, the court says, no, it didn't. The judge says it didn't affect it. You have federal cases saying that when the judge is the same judge at the sentencing and at the post-conviction motion hearing, and the judge says it didn't have an effect on me, that essentially gives the defendant the due process relief that he's entitled to, which is the judge saying, I would have sentenced you the same thing. It's basically the form of resentencing in the guise of a post-conviction motion. So at this point, I think that my position is that what the judge said at the post-conviction motion hearing, amplifying what he said at the sentencing hearing, shows that basically he didn't rely. I mean, it didn't rely in the sense of actual reliance in terms of I have to sentence him to 5 years, so therefore I'm going to, you know, and I think I need to give him more or something for that reason. The judge was saying, I think you deserve this amount, regardless of whether there was a mandatory minimum or not. And that, to me, is the issue of on actual reliance. And I think that also shows that it was harmless beyond any doubt, much less that it even affected the decision at all.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. You all have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Agopian, Attorney Agopian representing the defendant, Lamont Travis.
May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Agopian and I represent Lamont Travis. Well, we're asking the court to do one thing, not six, and that is to affirm the Court of Appeals. I think the Court of Appeals got it right. Mr. Travis should get a new sentencing hearing. He should have a sentencing at which the participants, the court, the prosecutor, defense counsel, the author of the pre-sentence report, Mr. Travis himself, are operating under a correct understanding of the penalty set by the legislature. And what that means here is an understanding that the legislature did not mandate a mandatory minimum 5-year term of confinement for his crime. Now, I agree with Justice Bradley that the court's comments post-conviction seem both inconsistent, but I would say also concerning. And the comments that I see as concerning are when the court seems to be disavowing any consideration of a mandatory minimum. I think what the court was trying to say is, well, what really was more important to me was his record. But what the court said was it really was of no consequence. It really didn't, I want to get the language right here. That the mandatory minimum did not have any bearing on sentencing. Those comments, I don't think, can comport with what our separation of powers has said, that sentencing is a shared power. The legislature has the power to set the penalty. The court imposes sentence, but it has to do that within the framework of what the legislature has said. And so when we have the legislature speaking, particularly in terms of a mandatory minimum, which is what everybody thought applied here, we really have a circumstance where that has to be part of the basis of the sentence imposed. Because as Justice Gableman alluded to, when you have a mandatory minimum, particularly a confinement term, that's got to be the starting place of the court's exercise of discretion. Look at, in Wisconsin, under our sentencing case law, McCleary and affirmed in Galleon, the court has told sentencing courts that we start at the bottom and work up. We don't start at the maximum and work down. And the principles that dictate that are two. One, that probation should be the first alternative.
Presumption is probation.
Exactly. And the second is that if confinement is imposed, the court should impose the minimum amount of confinement that's consistent with the seriousness of the offense, the character of the defendant, and the need to protect the public. So we start at the bottom. When the legislature has imposed a mandatory minimum, the legislature is foreclosing options that otherwise would have been available, probation. Or, in this instance, 1, 2, 3, 4 years of confinement. At least that's what everybody thought. So as a matter of law, the court had to begin its exercise of discretion with 5 years. So I don't think we can accept, and that this court should not write an opinion that would in any way condone statements from the trial court that the mandatory minimum was of no consequence. Now, I was interested in Mr. Wren's statement that had the Court of Appeals not used the term structural error, they would not have sought review in this court. I think that's significant because structural error, I think, is far less important than the concept that this sort of error, the erroneous belief that the individual is subject to a mandatory minimum when they're not, is the kind of error that requires a resentencing. Frankly, I don't care whether it's called structural error, presumed prejudice, per se prejudice, automatic prejudice, or may I suggest one even more specifically defined, I think that fits particularly well with Tiepelman. Because contrary to the state's argument here, the Court of Appeals decision does not dismantle Tiepelman. We don't want to dismantle Tiepelman. We would tweak it a bit for this unusual circumstance. What I would say makes sense would be this. When we have this sort of error, the belief erroneously that the individual is subject to a mandatory minimum term of confinement, the state cannot meet its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. And said more specifically, the state cannot meet its burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the court's reliance on this inaccuracy did not contribute to the sentence imposed.
Well, all you're doing in my view, you're saying, okay, harmless error applies, but here, state loses because you can't prove under these circumstances that it was harmless. So all you're saying is, under this fact situation, it is prejudicial error. You don't have to say per se or not. The next case that comes along that has the exact same error, you ought to apply the same rule.
Well, you could say that it's, but then aren't you saying it's per se prejudicial? Because you're not.
No, you might have a fact situation where it's not, where the defendant really knows it's not and holds back and you're going, and shouldn't have, or the counsel have gained the system or misled the court or something else that takes precedence over that. But what I hear you really saying is it's not structural error. It really is a harmless error issue, but there's no way in this kind of case you can call it harmless.
I'm perfectly fine with that, but my concern would be that whenever we start to talk about harmlessness, we're looking a lot at what the court said, which is fair, at sentencing and at the post-conviction hearing. And, you know, I've pointed out, and Justice Bradley pointed out, the other inconsistent comment, which seemed to show that there was, this was a factor in the decision. But the court kind of says multiple things, and so that could get difficult. But I do think the court could write an opinion that this sort of error under the facts of this case is prejudicial, recognizing that something like a mandatory minimum is not like other sorts of factual errors at sentencing.
Isn't that just another way of saying a case-by-case analysis?
Possibly. And frankly, you know, even though there's much concern about the Court of Appeals' use of the term structural error, it does sort of eviscerate a gut response. But really, when you read the opinion, it is so narrow, the holding in that case, because it found it to be structural error because the error evaded the entire case, as the trial court recognized, from charging through plea to sentencing. So the actual holding of this case is in that unusual circumstance where you have an error, the erroneous belief of a mandatory minimum all the way through the case. The Court of Appeals says we view that as structural.
And by all people, the judge, the defendant, defense counsel, prosecutor, everyone was in error. This
exactly.
is not one group in error.
Exactly. So this case really is unique in that sense. There are instances, I've had cases where the court has gotten the penalty wrong at sentencing. Sometimes it's hard to tell if it was almost a slip of the tongue because it's correct everywhere else. But that's not the circumstance here. And, you know, and that's what everybody acknowledged at the post-conviction hearing. We just had this wrong. And so I am a little bit concerned about the state's argument in this court, which it made in the Court of Appeals, and Court of Appeals said was frivolous, this idea that maybe it wasn't wrong, that even though there weren't any facts alleged in the complaint to support the element that would have been necessary to trigger the mandatory minimum, that maybe somehow we can conclude that he really was subject to a mandatory minimum, and I guess I don't want to give that more credence than it deserves because I frankly agree with the Court of Appeals.
Well, you know, I read this Court of Appeals decision, and it's the last couple of pages. It's Appendix 111, 112. And I just took out everything that said structural error. I said, so it read, Travis has the burden that the information was inaccurate and that the court relied on it, the burden shifts the state to prove the error was harmless. So then I leave out the next sentence because it has the word structural. And I leave out the next paragraph because it has structural. And I think that on the next paragraph just says it was pervasive. Then the next paragraph says that the error affected fairness, integrity, and public reputation. All participants operated under the assumption of mandatory minimum. And then you keep going on, it's impossible to measure the breadth. The error affected the state's charging, plea, communications, negotiations, due process right to be sentenced on accurate information was violated. As the pervasive error seriously affected the fairness and integrity of the sentence, we hold that instead of structural error, prejudicial error, requiring a reversal of the circuit court's denial. You'd go along with that?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, this court has granted resentencing in circumstances without declaring the error structural. We have the Koopmans case, the sentencing in absentia. We have State versus Smith, the breach of the plea bargain, which the court used the phrase automatic prejudice. And I think it's interesting there that the state had argued that what it should do is this court should remand back to the trial court for determination if this defendant would have gotten the same sentence, even, you know, if the prosecutor had made the recommendation that he or she was bound under the agreement. And this court rejected that request. And it said that such a review on remand would necessarily involve speculation and calculation. That it wasn't comfortable with the idea that we send it back and ask the court, would you have done the same thing? Now, we have a sentencing and post-conviction structure in this state where whenever the defendant wants to raise a sentencing issue, we've got to do it back in the trial court. So we do give the court an opportunity to comment on any sort of sentencing error that we may raise. And I'm not saying that what a judge says at a post-conviction hearing should not be entertained, but it also would not be dispositive. And I think with both a breach of an agreement and the erroneous belief that the individual was subject to a mandatory minimum, those are the sorts of errors that it is especially difficult for the trial court retrospectively to figure out whether this affected the sentence. I think maybe a judge could conclude this wasn't the most important. The only reason, you know, I gave him this much time was because of this. But when you're talking about a harmless error standard with inaccurate information, even generally, the federal courts really are using language more like, did it contribute to the sentence? Didn't have to be the most important factor. Some of the earliest cases, including the Seventh Circuit decision in Welch, did it form part of the basis of the sentence? It's really hard to say that a mandatory minimum would not have formed part of the basis of the sentence, not if the court is giving the due deference, as it must, to the legislature's authority to set the penalty. I would be remiss if I did not address United States versus Adigan. This is the case that was decided within the last couple of weeks, a Seventh Circuit decision that Mr. Wren submitted to the court yesterday. Let me start with the obvious proposition that that case is not binding in any way on this court. To the extent it has any persuasive authority, I would say it's really minimal for at least three reasons. First of all, it's an odd case because at the time the federal district court sentenced Mr. Adigan, the penalty that the court thought was in effect was the right penalty. So it's not really an inaccurate information case. What happened there, that district court was operating under controlling authority from the court right above it, the Second Circuit, saying that you are to use the older mandatory minimum, and that's what the court did. The U.S. Supreme Court then subsequently said, no, you know, this involved all the changes that with the federal sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimums, crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. And the U.S. Supreme Court then subsequently said, no, what was in effect actually for that sentencing, not that individual, but all of those in that category, would have been the newer, lower mandatory minimum. So it's an odd case in that it really wasn't inaccurate at the time of sentencing. And in Attigan, the Seventh Circuit really doesn't discuss this as an inaccurate information. It doesn't talk about, you know, reliance and the traditional standard in Welsh. What it does is it jumps right to harmless error. And what's significant is that its harmless error analysis is premised solely on the fact that there's also a federal sentencing guideline in play here. And obviously, we don't have that. So we had, in Attigan, both the legislative dictate of a mandatory minimum, but also the dictate of a federal sentencing guideline. And the sentencing court declined the defendant's request to sentence below the guideline. In fact, it sentenced right at the lowest level of the guideline. That was above any mandatory minimum, either the new or the old. And so the Seventh Circuit really was relying on the fact that it could determine in that instance that the error was harmless because under the federal system, not only was there a mandatory minimum, there was a guideline, and the court explained why it would not go below the guideline.
Counselor, I have something that, you know, it hasn't really been talked about much, and maybe because it's not relevant, but the complaint charges him with 948.021D, and that does carry a mandatory minimum. At the time of the plea hearing, the complaint was never amended to 1E, which doesn't carry a mandatory minimum. And he admitted to the crime as charged in the complaint. So I'm not completely sure why the mandatory minimum has no. I mean, you could certainly argue that the mandatory minimum is effective. That's what he pled to. That's what the legislature decided upon for the crime to which he pled. So maybe it wasn't an error to bring it up and mention it. Could you address that a little bit? I've been trying to find what they did in the record, which
certainly.
I haven't read for a while, but.
Certainly.
Thank you.
To trigger the mandatory minimum under 1D, there's an element there that would require that the sexual contact was with use or threat of force or violence.
I understand that, and I just reread the complaint, and I understand
right.
The complaint does not allege the use of threat or violence, but in the sentencing, they rely on a CAC tape, which is the assault from the child's perspective, as well as the complaint. I have not looked at that. So
right. Okay.
I guess what I'm wondering is, by admitting to the charge, is the state limited to the facts alleged in the complaint unless they're brought out at the time of sentencing? I guess maybe that's what's kind of bothering me.
Okay. This CAC tape is a complete red herring, and I really hope the court doesn't go down that path.
I haven't read it. I just looked at it here.
The CAC tape is the child's videotaped interview. Mm-hmm. It's not part of the appellate record, but you know what? It's not part of the trial court record. We have no reason to believe that this judge watched the CAC tape. There was an order entered that gave the parties permission and the judge permission, but that's it.
Well,
and
he says a factual basis, this is a judge, is gleaned from a reading of the complaint and the reference context of the CAC tape, which is further illustration of the conduct from the child's perspective.
Yes, but that reference to the CAC tape
yeah.
is indeed in the complaint. So he's referring to the complaint references the CAC tape.
Not his reading it.
No,
or hearing
and
this
it? Is what the complaint says about the CAC tape. That it was confirmed in that interview that his hand did reach what she referred to as the pubic area. All right? So there's nothing in this complaint or anywhere else in this record to indicate that there was use or threat of force or violence, and no reason to believe it's in the CAC tape. And when the court found the factual basis, it was referencing what the complaint says about the CAC tape.
I'm going to ask that question, but differently, which
okay, thank you.
I pose to the state. How can we, or you all, or the Court of Appeals, amend the complaint to be the lesser offense, that is, without violence? And how can we then say the defendant, we can treat this as that's the new complaint? The defendant has pled guilty to the new complaint, no violence. He's never pled guilty to that. And we got to resentence him on the basis of a new complaint and a new plea. This is all whole cloth. The complaint was for a violent offense. He pled to the violent offense. The violent offense has a mandatory minimum. What are we doing here?
Well, I understand where you're coming from, but I would say okay. He did not plead to a violent offense. There are no facts alleged in the complaint.
Why isn't he withdrawing the plea?
Conceivably, he could. He doesn't want to. You know, this is a man who never seriously entertained going to trial in this case. And that is verified by a letter, and I apologize, I don't know the exact date of it, but it was written by Mr. Travis to the court very shortly after he was charged. And it talked about, you know, he says he was drunk, he doesn't really remember what happened, but consistently has said, I have no reason to doubt my niece. She says this happened, it happened. Conceivably, a plea withdrawal could have been sought. It wasn't sought. The request was for merely resentencing. This was brought back into the trial court. The state, at that point, would have had the opportunity to say, sort of along the lines of what the Chief Justice is saying, wait a minute, he pled to the violent offense. We meant to charge a violent offense. The mandatory minimum applied. They didn't say that. The prosecutor from the office who is responsible for bringing the charges said it was an error. That mandatory minimum does not apply. And that's an appropriate concession, given how the complaint, the facts are the most important part of this complaint, because under 968.
Well, then your response to me is, in effect, the prosecutor amended the complaint. Defendant is really pleading to that complaint. Mm-hmm. Now you need a resentence.
You need resentencing, and to tidy up this record, I think the Court of Appeals was right as well, that any then new judgment that would be entered should refer to 1E instead of 1D. Because really, that's the point where this case is at. Everybody agrees that he did not plead to an offense of violence, that was a mistake to have charged the mandatory minimum. And then the offense that fits is 1E. And that's what should appear on the judgment of conviction.
Well, if he withdrew his plea, he'd face the other charges that were dismissed as part of the plea negotiation.
Right.
So
right.
That's why he doesn't want to withdraw his plea. He just wants a new sentencing. I mean,
but, you know, there's multi factors considered. Frankly, a resentencing is not risk free either.
I agree.
It's not. Justice, I do want to point out one thing, because there was an error in the state's reply brief, and I don't want any misconception of this, on the last page where it referred to the plea agreement having resulted in the charge having been amended down to an attempt, that's not correct. It was always charged as an attempt, not a completed crime.
Yeah, but when the court went through the elements, violence and threat of use of force wasn't in there, so that would be another basis upon which you could seek to withdraw the plea. I mean, no one contemplated that when this plea was taken. So there are a lot of reasons why you could do that.
Right.
At least when I read the record, when someone's right. getting at least two other cases dismissed as part of a plea negotiation, that's probably why you just want a new sentencing instead of to withdraw a plea.
Well, he certainly would have had the option of trying to withdraw the plea, and he chose not to do that. And certainly from the community's standpoint, the court's standpoint, a new sentencing hearing is a far less expenditure of resources than taking this case back to before the plea, which would entertain the possibility of this child victim having to testify at some proceeding. So my client chose to seek a resentencing. I cannot imagine, frankly, why the state would suggest that perhaps a larger remedy should apply. I don't see how that's in anybody's interest. And I would ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Whether it chooses to adopt the language of structural error is really of no concern to myself or my client. If the court were to refer to this as presumed prejudice, prejudice per se, or simply that on these facts the state could not meet its burden of proving this error harmless, I think the court would be reaching the right result, however it framed it.
What were the other charges that were dropped?
They were in separate cases.
Pardon me?
They were brought in two separate cases. That's why they don't really appear as part of this record.
I didn't remember.
Right.
That.
Okay. There was one felony, failure to register as a sex offender, and then there was misdemeanor obstructing or resisting.
08CF643 and 08CM2317.
Ms. Agopian, do you really think that this is structural error?
You know, I think it fits it pretty well. But I have to say others in my office felt differently. And I have to take some...
I can understand why.
I have to take some responsibility having... But the phrase I used was that this is akin to structural error. When I wrote the post-conviction motion, the part that made sense to me, Your Honor, was that when you believe there's a mandatory minimum when there isn't, and especially when it does pervade the entire case, but even at just at sentencing, it disrupts the framework of that proceeding. And I concede, we usually think of structural error in the terms of a case where there has been a trial, but it doesn't have to be. It can be an error just at sentencing. And I would submit that this sort of error does indeed disrupt the framework of the sentencing proceeding, and it also undermines the fairness and integrity of the proceeding. So I kind of like the phrase, but I can understand how it gets a reaction of, are we confusing things here?
Well, if it's structural error, there should be complete reversal, shouldn't there?
No.
Shouldn't your argument be this whole thing should be reversed?
No. Because structural error can occur just at sentencing. For example, if there's a denial of the right to counsel at sentencing, the remedy is a new sentencing hearing. You don't have a new trial. Same with if you have a biased judge at sentencing, the remedy is a new sentencing hearing. Nothing broader than that. I understand that there seems a little bit of inconsistency where the Court of Appeals emphasized so much the fact that this pervaded the entire case, and that's why it called it structural error. So then you think, well, maybe something more than resentencing should happen. So I would not in any way fault the court if it chose to use different terminology. But I don't think anything would dictate, require anything more than a resentencing, even using the phrase structural error or akin to structural error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. counsel. Mr. Wren?
I'll see what I can do here. I think the reason the court used structural error is because that's what Travis called it and didn't make any qualification. It started out as akin to structural error and then moved into structural error. We have well-defined, we have a number of Supreme Court cases and cases from this court explaining what structural error is. And yes, structural error mandates an automatic reversal, not just a resentencing, but an automatic reversal because of the very character of what a structural error is. As I said in my brief, yes, there are structural errors that occur at sentencing, but they're confined to sentencing and they relate to errors that have already been defined as structural error. Denial of counsel at sentencing. That doesn't pervade the entire case, but it is a structural error itself and can be confined to sentencing because that's the only place it occurred. So when we say, oh, well, I really don't care about what the language is, language matters in this case because structural error has a meaning that has been defined by the U.S. Supreme Court and accepted by this court. To now start saying, well, it kind of bears on the fairness of the proceeding, or it undermines the integrity of the court, that provides the wedge into redefining structural error in a way that, well, this court knows, and we certainly know, that even pro se litigants are very clever in being able to wedge things into changes in language, changes in meaning. The Strickland case was regarded at the time as a way of confining claims of ineffective assistance and reducing the number of claims that would arise in the courts. We know what's happened since then. We see that in nearly every criminal case that comes across our desk.
Meet the standard.
Pardon?
Very few meet the standard.
I understand
that.
It's
a loser.
I understand that. But it's also a claim that gets made because sure. of the way it goes. If you dilute the meaning of structural error, you will find that all kinds of claims are going to become structural error. I think it's very important.
It seems to me that the public defender agrees largely with you, or at least some members thereof. So the real issue is, to me, if you have, and you don't have to concede that this case is one of them, but if you have a case in which the trial judge says, this is mandatory minimum 5, I understand that, I started 5, and then I have to decide whether I'm going to go up, and you deserve up from 5, mm-hmm. considering that's the mandatory minimum, and I'm going to give you 8. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had total reliance and it pervaded all of sentencing, let's just forget about the rest of it. Can this court hold that it's prejudicial error?
I think you could find on those facts that the state could not prove harmlessness.
Okay.
When the judge says, yeah, that I was relying on that. And I think the interesting thing about the Adigan case was that it started out with the judge putting aside the guideline sentencing. Under Ms. Hagopian's argument, you start at the mandatory minimum. You can't adjust down from that when you're considering whether there was reliance. Well, what happened was there was a 10-year minimum that the court later said only a 5-year minimum should have applied. The court of the Seventh Circuit says, we think it's harmless. We don't have to worry about whether there was the mandatory minimum of 10 or 5. There are these other things that occurred. It looked at other things that the judges did and the rationale the judge gave and said, it's clearly harmless. We think the same thing can apply here. If you decide that you're going to reject the trial judge's statements that, yeah, this was in the background, but it really wasn't, I was going to be sentencing this guy anyway because of the nature of the offense and the nature of his the character of his history, that he had these other crimes that of a similar nature. If you say that shows actual reliance, that Travis has met his clear and convincing burden based on those statements, then we can move to harmless error. And I think that it is harmless that the judge did not rely on it. I think you can find that. You don't necessarily have to, but you don't necessarily have to do it yourselves. You could remand it and ask the Court of Appeals to determine. But I think you've got a sufficient record that you can do it here. I don't think remanding it back to the circuit court for the judge to then decide a harmless error claim in this case makes much sense, because the judge has already said, I didn't rely on it. It seems to me unreasonable to think that the judge is going to come back and say, well, I said before I didn't rely on it, so clearly I think it's harmless.
But the judge, if sent back and goes to the same judge, can say, you get 8 years.
Yeah, could. And depending on what his conduct has been in the interim, could wind up with more. I don't know what his conduct has been, but I mean, that's the risk he runs on resentencing. It's a similar kind of risk to, may not be as great a risk as seeking to withdraw a plea, but I do think that this court can decide the harmlessness error based on the Tiepelman framework and the court's holding in Harris that the clear and convincing standard applies to the initial determination of whether there was actual reliance on inaccurate information. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wren, and thank you, Ms. Hagopian, for your arguments on yet another case relating to the appropriateness of the justice of a judge's sentencing, but yet in a different context. And that concludes our hearing in 11AP 685, State of Wisconsin versus Lamont L. Travis.